And counsel, you ready to go? I want to remind you, 15 minutes for your case in chief presentation, 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name and the party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellate DeAndre Tate. This appeal stems from the denial of a petition for post-conviction relief in the Hennepin County District Court in April of 2018. The petition that Mr. Tate raised had three claims in it, but what really underlying all of his claims was his contention that he suffered prejudice due to the lack of timely written notice of the prosecution's intent to seek an aggravated sentence where no written notice was given. An oral motion was made to the court on March 18th of 2014, with jury selection starting immediately after the motion and the jury trial itself starting the next morning. The district court ruled that the claims were procedurally barred, but also said that there was no merit to Mr. Tate's claim that he had suffered prejudice as a result of not being made aware in a timely written manner of the intent to seek an aggravated sentence. At least from my client's perspective in this case, I think the primary issue here is whether that underlying claim has merit such that he could be granted relief on either his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim or potentially his other claims, because if there's prejudice, and I'll touch on this a little bit toward the end of my argument here, then we think we can meet the interest of justice exception for the two trial-based claims, but I don't even think we need it for the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. And I think what we're looking at in terms of prejudice here is we're talking specifically about a requirement that the defendant be given timely written notice of the intent to seek an aggravated sentence. And Rule 703 says, I think in the comments, that this should be given as early as possible so the defendant can actually have time to prepare a defense. And what I think this, and we talked about this in some of the federal cases in our brief, this need for notice really stems from notice being more than just what you can prove or not prove at trial, which at this case it had to do with the age of JB, one of the victims, and also the location of JB. But I think notice does more than that. And if we look at the federal cases and even Rule 703, what it says is that notice is the opportunity to present a defense. And a defense is more than just what you can prove or not prove at trial, but it's having the defendant with an opportunity at a time that's meaningful to him to understand what all the charges are, what they mean, what the potential outcome of the case is, how much time you can get, and to do that at a time when it means something to him. And in this case, there was a note, and it's in the quotations from the oral motion about the aggravated sentence, noting that there was discussions and a deadline for a plea in February and things like that. And really, if we have a defendant in this case who Mr. Tate claims he had no idea about the fact that a victim being a child could result in this long of a sentence, that he didn't know that at the time when he's deciding, am I going to take a plea agreement? Am I going to go to trial? What am I going to do to protect my best interest in this case? And it's our position that prejudice arose specifically because he didn't have the notice at that time.
Counsel,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Counsel, going past the notice issue for a minute, isn't the real issue before this court what he knew in terms of what his appellate counsel was going to argue?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Doppler seems to be a case that would be relevant here. Isn't the issue what your client knew his appellate counsel was going to argue?
I think that that's relevant in this case and that he asked to have that issue raised and it wasn't raised. But I think, at least from our perspective and the way I read these cases, if this court leaves here convinced that Mr. Tate was prejudiced by the lack of notice, then I think it would meet both of the Strickland prongs related to appellate counsel, both deficient performance and prejudice to Mr. Tate if counsel left an argument that would have been successful on the table.
Even if Mr. Tate knew that it wasn't going to be argued, is that your position?
I think it is, Your Honor, particularly because he requested that it be, and I think that that's an indication that he made counsel aware about it and that it should have been raised if it was going to be, and if this court believes he was prejudiced, then I think we can satisfy that requirement.
But there was no evidentiary hearing, was there? Was he ever put under oath and asked what he knew was going to be argued?
No, there was not. This case was disposed of without an evidentiary hearing. And as I went back through the record in this case, I'm not aware of any time where Mr. Tate made any statement about what he knew or didn't know about what these aggravating factors would mean toward his case and toward the amount of time that he might get in that case. And so I don't think that there's any, and where that comes in is Mr. Tate has submitted an affidavit in this case, and in that affidavit he essentially says, I didn't know about these aggravating factors, I didn't know what they were gonna mean. I learned about them on March 18th of 2014, and then my counsel told me what it meant about my sentence when we came for sentencing. And I think that's part of the district court's determination that Mr. Tate was not prejudiced in this case had to do with it looking at the record and saying, well, it seems like he knew about it ahead of time because his counsel.
Back up a little bit. So there wasn't a hearing. There wasn't an evidentiary hearing, but his affidavit is indicating that he learned or knew of the possibility before he was sentenced, before sentence was imposed? Maybe I didn't hear you right. I'm trying to clarify it.
I think I have it here to make absolutely sure, but I believe that what his affidavit says was the first that he heard about there being aggravating factors and the possibility of an aggravated sentence was on March 18th of 2014. And then that he wasn't actually told what that meant as far as doubling his sentence and what the outcome could be until the day they showed up for sentencing. And what the district court looked at and determined there was no prejudice was that Mr. Tate's counsel said that there had been some communications about the possibility of the state seeking an aggravated sentence if Mr. Tate didn't take a plea agreement. And then his counsel said that Mr. Tate wouldn't be prejudiced by having that added. But I think what it doesn't show in the record that's relevant toward Mr. Tate's knowledge is that there's nothing in there that indicates that counsel sat down and talked to Mr. Tate and said, look, these are what the aggravating factors are going to be. This is what impact they would potentially have on how long of a sentence that you could have in this case. Here's what we can do to defend against them factually at trial or not. And Mr. Tate might have learned facts that he didn't really like about his case that put him in a different position to make a decision when it was meaningful to him how to defend himself. And that could include, am I going to reconsider this plea deal? And I think that the transcript notes indicate that plea discussions went on until right before they walked into the court on March 18th of 2014. And so I think that it indicates that he didn't know about that at the time. And that's really where the prejudice
counsel,
is.
You're referencing trial counsel, correct?
Correct.
And isn't that NAFLABARD, that portion of it?
I think our position is that it's not. And the NAFLA rule is that anything that was raised or known in, at the time can't be raised later. But there's exceptions to that, and one of them is the interest of justice exception. And I think that in a case where we're looking at, if Mr. Tate is able to show that he was prejudiced, I think that it would meet those interest of justice requirements. And there's five of them, and they come from the Gassler case. But I think that if he's able to show here today that he was prejudiced, that he could check all five of those boxes so that that claim on its own would not be procedurally barred under the circumstances where he's able to show that he was prejudiced.
Well, if we decide that the focus is on appellate counsel, what's your position on that?
I think that if Mr. Tate is able to show prejudice, he can obtain relief under any of those claims. And the appellate counsel claim is probably better positioned for that because it's a claim that can't be procedurally barred under the circumstances because the first opportunity to bring that is after the direct appeal is finished up. So this was really the first opportunity to raise that claim, and then what he's done is raise the claims that he thinks should have been provided under there. And I just want to touch kind of briefly on why I don't think the record supports the conclusion that Mr. Tate was aware of these facts at a time when it could mean something to him.
Before you do that, I just want to finish up that thought. So is it your argument then that because it was he did not have that opportunity through appellate counsel to raise that issue, there's no evidentiary hearing, is that how, in a derivative way, he gets back to the same issue of the Strickland standard? In other words, if it after an evidentiary hearing and the trial court determines that it was error for the appellate counsel not to raise it, that's the court's looking at those same issues, but we're focusing on the appellate counsel, not trial counsel.
That is our position, Your Honor, and I think, I'm not sure of exactly which case it is we cited that says that, but there's case law that deals with if the claim is that it was deficient representation for not arguing a claim during direct appeal, you have to prove the success of the underlying claim in order to show both that there was deficient performance and that there was prejudice necessary to obtain relief. And so that's what we're attempting to do, is show that there was the prejudice in the underlying claim, and had it been raised at the right time and in the right way, it would have been successful, since that Mr. Tate would have had relief. And I think that when we're looking at this, he is an individual who went into this case. He was 35 years old, no prior felony history. He's married, has kids, he's a homeowner, he works two jobs, and there's really no reason to expect that he would know what this idea of aggravating factors means, what impact it would have on his case, unless and until he's told about it by his counsel. And really what drives that in a case like this is giving the proper timely notice that allows him to make these decisions about how to defend himself, what to do, at least that he perceives is best for his liberty interest, and make decisions like that in a timely manner. And we feel like in this case, Mr. Tate was deprived of that when he was not given an opportunity to make those decisions with that knowledge. In the absence of questions, I don't have anything further.
Thank you. Before you start, Ms. Burdoff, I was remiss in addressing both counsel at the beginning of the hearing. We are aware that you have filed a motion to strike portions of respondent's brief. Factual matters that are not part of the record will not be considered, but we will take that into consideration in issuing our opinion and address it in that fashion.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. I am going to start with the NAFLA issue. Chief Judge Cleary, given your questions, you know what the NAFLA rule is. The argument that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object to written notice of aggravating facts was the claim at the district court. In this second post-conviction proceeding. That claim was known at the time of Mr. Tate's first appeal and the first post-conviction remand hearing, and then those two were consolidated. That claim was known. There is no way anyone can claim that Mr. Tate didn't know about the aggravated sentence at that point. So your question, Chief Judge Cleary, about the really what role does appellate counsel have to play in the NAFLA bar? And I think Mr. Longsdorf was right when he said that to prevail or to escape the NAFLA bar in this case, he would have to show that appellate counsel rendered ineffective assistance in not raising that failure or alleged failure to object to written notice as a basis for an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim in the first appellate proceeding. So I hope that's clear. I get jumbled a little bit when it's all this procedural stuff, but the answer to that question, I think, is relatively simple. Appellate counsel would have had no reason to raise that as a ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim because you look, again, at the underlying issue. Yes. The state conceded there was no written notice of the aggravating facts before the omnibus hearing. That was not in dispute. What Mr. Longsdorf has neglected to mention is that there was oral notice, and the trial counsel conceded that a couple different times during the trial record, said, yes, I understand that they didn't give us written notice, but we've known about it. And he uses the pronoun we. We've known about this. We've known they were going to seek an aggravated sentence. The state in this case held off.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. You're aware of defense counsel, and I'm certainly aware of defense counsel. Wouldn't a good defense counsel say, yeah, you didn't give me a written notice, it's too late?
He did say that he didn't get written notice. The defense counsel...
And not concede anything past that point? I mean, to protect your client? I mean, to concede you received oral notice so that they find a way around the rule, that seems to me the height of ineffectiveness.
And I look at it a different way, which I think trial counsel for the defense was acting with candor to the court. He agreed that he, I mean, I don't think that there's any dispute that these parties were trying to negotiate this case.
I have to stop you for a minute. Are you suggesting it was unethical of counsel to say he didn't receive written notice and remain silent at that point?
If what happened is the prosecutor said that trial counsel had oral notice and the district court questioned and said, did you have oral notice? And I think at that point he's obligated to say in candor, yes, I did know about it.
Well, I don't think the district court should be asking that question. If there's a rule that says written notice, then what's the court asking if you received oral notice? I don't understand.
I think the reason that that's the conversation is because case law from this court and the Supreme Court says that it's essentially an error in failing to provide written notice of aggravating facts is harmless if the party here, the defendant, was on actual notice that the prosecution was going to do it. So I think that's why the conversation becomes relevant, is because errors happen. People fail to file timely notice. I mean, a written notice was eventually filed in this case. It just wasn't timely. And so the question really is, when you're looking at fairness from the defense point of view, is did he know that the state was going to do this? And the answer to that is unequivocally yes. The defense, and in this case, knew that the state, if they did not resolve it through a guilty plea, was going to amend the complaint and was going to seek a Blakely hearing, in essence. And so I think when you're looking at it from that perspective, there really is no question the defense knew. And so
I agree that with the oral concession from counsel that it certainly appears that way, but I'm back to the zealous advocacy issue of a defense counsel conceding that when it has such major repercussions for his client.
Again, I think that when they're having the conversation, the issue is there harm here from the failure to provide written notice? And the true answer was no, there wasn't, because there was oral notice and the defense was on notice. And when a court asks you, I mean, I guess I practice in district court too, and when a district court judge asks me a question and says, did you know about that or did this happen, I tell them the truth, whether it hurts my case or doesn't.
Well, I understand you have to do that. I just think it's improper if there's a rule that says written notice of a judge helping the prosecution by going around that rule and saying, well, did you receive oral notice? So we'll just ignore the rule.
Right. And I don't think my read of the transcript isn't quite that way. I mean, I think the prosecutor was essentially arguing there's no prejudice here because we held off filing the written notice because we were in plea negotiations. He knew this was going to happen. This is no surprise. I think what the prosecution was doing is justifying or providing an explanation for why the written notice was not timely. And so they've presented a position and said, this is what happened. The district court says, is that accurate? I don't see that as being some error on the part of the district court. I think the district court's just trying to find out what happened and when there was really a cognizable harm at that point from failure to get the written notice out there.
Ms. Burdorf, wouldn't the response of counsel, the better one, would have been, yes, we receive oral notice, but we object because we did not receive written notice. At that stage under the rule, would not the judge have to sustain the objection unless, and that gets into the prejudice showing, which the counsel appellants pointed out, there's nothing in the record, but that would have ended it, wouldn't it? And they would not, and it's done. We object.
I don't actually agree with that because I think the case law in the state holds otherwise, which is it's not enough to just show a violation of the rule. There are discovery violations all the time. That doesn't end the inquiry. The inquiry is, has there been prejudicial harm? Is this something that should stop us from going forward with trial, or should we preclude aggravating facts at this point? And that question there was no question the notice of aggravating facts was untimely in this case. The state stood up, said untimely. The question the district court was trying to answer at that moment was, is that untimely notice sufficient to preclude the state from seeking aggravation in this case? And the case law in this state says you have to find out if there's actual harm. If a party like the defendant is on actual notice of the state's intention to do that, there is no harm. And it is a discretionary call at that point for the district court to then allow the state to, one, amend a complaint, and two, seek aggravation in sentencing. And that's what happened here. I don't think the district court judge did anything wrong here at all under the case law in Minnesota.
Would that not require some colloquy, though, with the defendant? Do you understand what the prison time would be if the aggravated factors is found and what it is without it? And do you have that all in mind when a plea's entered?
I think that's a different question. And maybe I answered, I heard your question and was answering the wrong question for you, so I apologize for that. I think certainly this record doesn't have anything in it about what the specifics of the plea negotiation were. What this record does contain, and contains up to today, is appellant's assertion that he's not guilty and that he's innocent. And so that factors largely into this conversation as well in this way, which is, take all the procedural default aside, you get down to the base question, which is, was he prejudiced by anything that happened? And the answer is no, and I think the district court was right about answering that question. There is no evidence in this record at all that Mr. Tate would ever have agreed to plead guilty. He maintained his innocence throughout.
But counsel, that, I certainly read that in the court's findings. People plead innocent throughout until they're often given a plea agreement that makes them reconsider. So I don't, seeing that someone said they insisted on their innocence all the way through it, and so they would have had they, whether they've been given a plea agreement or not, seems a little circular to me.
Well, this legal standard that has to be met, I mean, again, setting aside NAFLA and all the procedural default arguments, and there's actually two that I want to circle back to. It is the defendant's burden to prevail on a claim like this to show that there's a reasonable probability that they would have pled guilty and the district court would have accepted that guilty plea. So that's how you show prejudice in this context. One, there's no evidence in this record that the prosecutor would have done an Alford plea. My office, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, has a policy against doing Alford pleas. We do stipulated fact trials in lieu of that, which is something I'm sure the court's aware of.
But you're presuming that that he would maintain his innocence in the face of a favorable plea agreement. It wouldn't have to be an Alford plea.
It would have. I mean, I think it would have to be an Alford plea.
Why? Well, if you
appellant.
I know he maintained his innocence, but now you're offering him a plea agreement that's very favorable.
Right.
We don't know whether he would have withdrawn that innocence argument.
His affidavit said he was offered a plea agreement of 48 months. There's nothing in the record to refute that, so we accept that fact as true for post-conviction purposes. With a 48-month sentence, which was favorable, he knew, according to his own affidavit, that if he was convicted after a jury trial, that the prosecution was going to try to get a lot more time. So he acknowledges he knows that. He's going to get a lot more time than 48 months if he goes to trial. He maintained his innocence and was convicted. And he continues to this day to maintain his innocence.
Right, but a lot more time from 48 to 309, that's quite a gap.
It is a gap. But I think the point I'm trying to make is there is no evidence in this record that meets his burden of showing prejudice.
Well, is there evidence in this record that he knew his appellant counsel was not going to raise the argument that the written notice had not, incompetency of a trial counsel, talking about appellate counsel,
right?
In accepting the oral notice in lieu of fighting on the written notice.
In Mr. Langsdorff's reply brief, he cites a letter.
That's the
yes.
Need
that
to
is
point
the,
out that's the motion that you filed to.
It is, and that is
that considered. If it's not in the record, we do not consider it.
That's right. And in the absence of that reference, there is no indication in this record that Mr. Tate was unaware of the claims that his appellate counsel was going to raise, disagreed with those claims. There's just no evidence at all. Moreover, there's no evidence that even if Mr. Tate had asked him to present this claim, one, he could have done it in a pro se supplemental brief if his appellate counsel hadn't. But two, the idea to get out from under NAFLA here, you would have to show somehow appellate counsel was ineffective in failing to raise this claim. And I don't think that standard can be met either, because I don't think trial counsel was ineffective here. Trial counsel had oral notice of the fact that, made the objection, said we want a note for the record, we didn't get written objection, but was truthful with the district court. I don't think that you can say that is professionally unreasonable.
What about the fact that the court inquired as to whether, the court says, are you contesting that somehow your client's prejudiced by the way the notice was given? And
right.
Defense counsel says, no, Your Honor.
Right. And that is what defense counsel believed because he knew about the oral notice. The presumption in the law, in the absence of any evidence in the record, which there is none here, is that trial counsel adequately advised and discussed this with his client. So that's, I mean, that's the presumption that the law holds. And there's nothing in this record that actually supports that. To the contrary, and here's a sort of an ancillary point. I know I'm sort of jumping around here, but Mr. Tate in his affidavit says, I didn't know that there was anything about aggravating factors till I was sitting at the sentencing hearing. That assertion is contradicted by record evidence. There's all sorts of discussion about the fact that there's going to be aggravation, what those factors are. The parties worked on it. Mr. Tate sat through a jury trial where there was a Blakely finding made, and then he cites in his affidavit, well, I didn't know anything about that till I was sitting at sentencing. Under Salmon and Richmond decisions from this court doesn't have to accept that affidavit allegation. That kind of allegation isn't sufficient to trigger an evidentiary hearing and support this claim. And that sort of, so what we have is we have, there was a plea negotiation. He knew he was going to get a lot more time if he went to trial. He maintained his innocence. He went to trial. The written notice issue, I think, is kind of a red herring, to be honest with you. There was no prejudice from the fact that the written notice was late because they did have oral notice and they knew what was happening during this case. And this court, under your case law, should presume all of those facts are true.
Well, let's stop for a minute. Why do you think the written notice rule exists? Why does the written notice rule exist?
To give timely notice of what's going to happen at trial.
So it's an option for prosecutors?
That's not at all what I'm saying. We conceded at the district court level and concede here there was a violation of the rule. The question is whether the defendant suffered actual prejudice from that, and he didn't. And I think the record is fairly clear that he didn't because defense counsel knew about it. The only thing in the record that suggests that's not true is an allegation in Mr. Tate's affidavit that is contradicted by record evidence. And this court under Richmond and Salmon has said that that kind of allegation in an affidavit isn't sufficient to overcome the record evidence to the contrary. Unless you have additional questions, we would ask that you actually affirm the district court's denial of post-conviction relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Birdoff. Mr. Longstorff.
Rule 703 actually says that notice can be given later if permitted by the court on good cause and conditions that will not unfairly prejudice the defendant. And so that's really where things went haywire here is that counsel said, yeah, no prejudice, no problem. But what is the good cause here? It says right in the record the prosecutor could have done it, but she didn't feel like it, so she didn't. So I think an objection there does sustain it, keeps the sentence at a maximum of, I guess you'd run them consecutive, so 206. So I think there's prejudice there as well. And I want to talk about the Richmond and Salmon cases that are on page 15 of the respondent's brief. And I think that they're a lot more specific in the circumstances when a defendant's post-trial statement can be simply disregarded. And I don't have the cases with me, but I think the Salmon case really says that if it's the post-trial statement is contradicted by a prior sworn statement made by the defendant on the issue, then you don't have to consider his earlier or his later statement. And I think there's nowhere, at least that I'm aware of in the record of this case, where Mr. Tate was put on the under oath and said, all right, here's your plea offer, you understand, you know, that you could get 309 months or anything like that. So I don't really think that his affidavit contradicts anything that was sworn testimony under the previous time, so I don't think it can just be reconsidered. And I think a lot of what was talked about during Ms. Burdorf's argument is that we don't know, there's no proof of this in a record, and I think that in a post-conviction setting, the Minnesota Supreme Court has said where there's a sworn statement, and that sworn statement, if the evidence in it considered as true, might require the defendant be granted relief, that before we can just disregard it and start deciding all these facts against the defendant, we should hold an evidentiary hearing. And I think that's where a lot of these things would be resolved, was at a hearing about what Mr. Tate knew, when he knew it. Did he know about these things prior to hearing about them? Well, he's sitting in court 30 seconds before they start picking a jury, did he know about the fact that he could get 309 months or potentially even more than that just because he doesn't take a plea agreement? And what he didn't get because of that is an opportunity to make decisions in his defense, in his own best interest, and what he perceives to be the best way to protect his liberty interest. In a case where that didn't happen, he was prejudiced by what happened at trial and by not having those claims raised on appeal, and we'd ask that the case be remanded for imposition of the guideline sentence. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters are submitted, and a decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.